Welcome to Revolutionize Your Retirement Radio, bringing you insights and strategies to help you create a magnificent and fulfilling second half of life. Here's your host, certified professional retirement coach and best-selling author, Dr. Dorian Mincer.
I want to welcome everybody today to my fourth Tuesday Revolutionize Your Retirement Interview with Expert series. I'm Dori Mincer, your host and owner of Revolutionize Retirement. Without further ado, let me just start and introduce you to Mary. I met Mary Tyrell through Jan Hively, who is on the call today, and I want to thank Jan for that introduction. And I have to say, I have been learning so much reading Mary's articles as well as her book, and it's just amazing what you've established. Mary O'Brien Tyrell is the president of Memoirs, Inc. She has assisted hundreds of older individuals in publishing a life story in limited edition hardcover books that are distributed at a family book signing party. The company has been featured in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, VWF Magazine, and Kiplinger's Retirement Report. She really set up this program with the goal of designing a progressive model to honor elders, and she has definitely achieved that goal. She's also been recognized academically. Her articles were the first in academic gerontological literature to describe this emerging industry, the professional skills involved, and its effect on narrators. In 2012, she published Become a Memorist for Elders, Create a Successful Home Business, which is available on Amazon.com. She has a Bachelor of Science in Nursing and a Master of Public Health and Community Health Information. She's a Vietnam veteran and since then has specialized in gerontology. Her employment includes positions as Associate Director at the Minnesota Board of Nursing, Research Coordinator for a National Cancer Institute grant, and currently 22 years as President of Memoirs Incorporated. And the website, for those of you interested in checking it out, is memoirsinc.com. She's past president of the International Institute for Reminiscence and Life Review and provides a four-day continuing education intensive training as a memoirist personal historian at Bridgewater State University on Cape Cod, where she now lives. So let's begin, Mary, if we can, by sharing with us what was your inspiration that got you into writing life stories. Maybe we could just start with that. I think that would be a good beginning.
I had been in gerontology for 15 years, mostly doing research and program development. And I decided to take this big leap because I was inspired by a group of people. And it came from working with Native Americans who were the prototype for our educational intervention. When I was working in Minneapolis, in downtown Minneapolis, at the Hennepin County Medical Center. And to understand more about the Anishinaabe and Lakota tribes, I volunteered to serve food at the feast that was held for the elders. And this is people living in the Phillips neighborhood. And as I was, first of all, I was just delighted to be invited to help serve the food. And then when I showed up once a month to be one of the servers, I found that it was an experience that I had never had before. Even though I had worked in gerontology for 15 years, when I walked into this room where we were serving the elders, whenever an elder spoke, the whole room got quiet. No one spoke. Everybody listened to the elder. And even in the winter, an icy cold in Minneapolis, people would show up for this feast. And people who were 40 years old and older were considered an elder. I just was so impressed that they could manage to honor their elders in that way. And then secondly, I was working on a research project for the National Institutes of Health, and I had to learn how to run a computer. This is back in 1993. So I had the skills, and I thought, if they can do it, we can do it. But how do I transfer that special value that this community is giving to elders? And I thought about in the United States, if we honor someone, we like to know their life story. And in those days, we would pick up their biography or autobiography at the bookstore. Now, of course, that's changed. But I thought maybe since we have a growing group of elders and we have this growing use of personal computers, instead of thinking in terms of publishing a book for the whole world, maybe we could just publish books enough for the family. Who's most important to us? Our family. Maybe in limited edition. And I grabbed the number 30 out of the air. And when I started working with my first client, who said she would like to have her life story written so that she could distribute it to her family, she was a 52-year-old person in hospice. And as we started to work during the second interview, she said, because you're asking me all these questions, it feels like a dam's breaking open. I realize now I had a wonderful life. That message was, it struck me very strongly. And sadly, the night that she called and said, Mary, I want you to come tomorrow and read my book to me, we were finished. We had the pictures picked out. It had been edited. She was happy with the results. When I finished reading it to her that night, she said, okay, that's me. That's Jerry. And I got a call the next day that she had died.
Mm.
That hit me strongly. Secondly, I worked with a man who was 92 years old, the secretary across the hall at the hospital. And we distributed his book at a book signing party out at his farm in Wisconsin. It had about 75 people there. He was unwrapping his book, signing each one, and giving it to his great-grandchildren. And he looked up at me and said, this is the best day of my life. That was my inspiration. I have been writing life stories ever since.
Hmm. Those are wonderful examples. And I think just hearing how it evolved from seeing what happens with elders in Native America and then your friend and the first person, that the person across the hall from you, I'm just moved by the story that you just said. Why didn't you pursue a grant at the beginning, or did you?
That's a good question, and it's something I certainly considered because I had never been in small business, ever. I always worked for the government or a hospital or some big organization. But I knew, because I had worked with grants, that you go from one grant to the next grant to the next grant. As soon as you get one grant written and it's awarded, you have to start on the next grant. And I didn't want it to be that way. I really wanted the older person to have the power that the way they wanted to tell their story, they would be in charge. Mm-hmm. And so because of that, I thought if I have my own business, I can be sure that they have the power to control everything mm-hmm. about getting this project done.
Hmm. That's interesting. And one of the things that's so clear in your book, the book really does help somebody discover how to set up a business in this, which is, you share so much in it. It's wonderful. What's the hardest part? You've been doing this now for 20 plus years, and I can't imagine, and maybe that's not a good question, what's the hardest part, but because there are probably a bunch of hard parts to it. But what is the hardest part that you've been finding as you've been doing this?
There are some difficult parts because I think before I started into, I thought this will be quick. I'll just talk to people. They'll tell me. I'll write it down. But the hardest part is to, number one, be sure that the privacy of the narrator is kept so that they feel, again, that they are in charge. And there are so many possibilities when you are working out in the community that the family wants to take charge or that some other situation becomes more important than getting this done. And so I think keeping the privacy of the narrator is something that I always have as one of my biggest goals. And then the second thing is I had to really concentrate on being a good listener. Period. I wanted them to know who I was and to be warm, but the story was to be concentrated on the person. It wasn't like writing an article for a newspaper. It wasn't like writing an article for some kind of a report. This was really trying to get as close as I could to that person in respecting them so that as I put my words down on the computer, it was the words coming out of their mouth.
And you do all of the recording and transcribing yourself. Can you talk a little about how you made that decision?
Again, it's the same that I want when the family picks up the book, that they hear the voice of that person that I've been working with. And I have gotten that comment many times, and so I know that goal has been fulfilled. But as I listen to them talking, I make notes on a tablet so that there's no clicking computer, nothing distracting. I can keep eye contact with them and just take notes. And then when I go back to my office or my home, I transcribe it word for word so that the little nuances and the innuendos and what the word that they use to describe their parent, is it papa, is it dad, is it father, that all those little nuances are part and parcel of how the story gets put together.
There's really such a sensitivity to this.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have any mentors when you first started?
Zero. A lot of people laughed at me. They thought I was really going wacko because I had been doing research, and what was I doing, just becoming a secretary or something? It was the implication I got when I told people. But things have changed in 22 years. People now are really more hearing that this is something that older people should and need to do.
That's so important. Now, did you at the beginning work with people who started doing their own memoirs and then shift from that, or have you always from the get-go done the interviewing yourself and really written the whole thing yourself?
That's a good question. I have worked both ways, but mostly I have concentrated on interviewing myself and then doing the work for them. I have worked with some people who wrote it and then wanted help with getting it done. The interesting part is they in the end said, oh, I'm so glad I worked with you. Because they felt a relief of having a partnership. Because they're going to present this to their family, and it's going to be a document that's in the family for years. They, too, had that heavy weight. And it costs a lot of money, too. That's a second factor. It costs a lot of money to hire me to sit with them for a minimum of 10 hours of interviewing, and then I go home and do all this work. Then I contract with an editor, I contract with a printer, I contract with a book designer, and with a bindery. So it's a sizable amount of money that's involved here. That's the other reason that I have chosen to interview people for the most part. If they can do it themselves, I tell them I can recommend a book that's really good. It costs $12. How to Write the Story of Your Life by Frank P. Thomas. It was written in the 1980s. It's excellent. And then I don't feel guilty when people call and say, I'm living on Social Security. I really want to do this. Can I just pay you a little every month? I can't do that. If I was going to be able to support myself, I had to set limits. And I wanted my business to survive. And I had to pay bills. So that all fit together.
And it's been a full-time business for you for much of this 20-some years, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Who contacts you? Is it often a family member? Is it the person themselves? Or how do you begin the contract and how do you establish the contract?
Yes, there's a lot of questions. Once you start to get the picture of what we're doing, then it occurs to you that we've got a legal document in order for me to know what I'm going to be paid and for them to know how much they're going to have to pay me. And I really had to do some investigating when I began with who in the family cares about this? Who is going to hire me? I thought originally I'd go out and give talks to older people at their meetings somewhere. And I tried that. It doesn't work. They usually don't think their story is important enough to write it down, nor to pay something that's going to cost thousands of dollars. So then I kept track of all the contacts I was getting, and because I'm working intimately with these people, I know their birth order. And it occurred to me, thanks to the fact that this one family had been, the daughter kept calling and calling me, saying, my dad's a World War II vet, he's got to tell his story, I want to get it down, but I'm having trouble getting everybody together to do this. And after about the fifth call, because she really was sincere, she wanted it done. And I thought, okay, now maybe this can help me understand how the dynamics of the financial decision get made. So I said, come to my house and I'll serve you tea. And the sisters all showed up. They had a brother, but it was four sisters. And they sat in my living room. I served them tea and cookies. And then I stepped out into the kitchen and I listened to them. And they were arguing one thing and then another thing and then another thing. And sure enough, they walked out the door, hadn't made the decision. But I had some ironing to do in my basement. And I went downstairs and did some ironing. You know what happens when you iron, you think. And I thought, okay, what if this was my family? How would we make this decision? And I thought, my oldest sister would make the decision. And I figured out, because I knew this family well enough, who was the oldest sister. The oldest sister was controlling the conversation. The youngest sister wanted it done. And that's why they couldn't come together for the agreement. And I applied that over the next 18 years or something. Sure enough. So I
what happens if what happens if there's no older sister?
Then it's somebody who takes the place.
Huh?
And it's not a solid. It's about 80%, though. It's about 70 to 80%. It's the oldest sister that's really driving the process, which was valuable information. So I had a friend at the University of Minnesota in the family science, and I said, is there any documentation anywhere that says the oldest daughter has a lot of power in the family? And she said, no. I said, really? I said, the next time you get a PhD candidate, have her investigate it. Because I go by that. I still go by that. It's really powerful.
That is very interesting. So how many of these do you do, like a month or a year?
It varies depending on how long the stories are or how much travel I have to do. Because I went to Canada and 17 different states doing this work. Mm-hmm. And in the process, I have published 289 memoirs. There are more, some of them that I just stood on the side and helped them with, but those are officially 289 people that I worked with. And I usually would do 20 to 30 a year. Uh-huh. It takes a long time to do one story.
Around how long? I know you say it in the book, but what have you discovered to be, I know each story is different, but in general, if talking about the interviewing process, well, the contract process and the interviewing, the writing, and you also pull together pictures and other mementos for this book, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And then you actually have it, you write it, you send it to
edited?
The person, is that edited
mm-hmm.
it, send
mm-hmm.
it to the person, then a final copy, and then you have it bound as
mm-hmm.
a hardcover book.
Mm-hmm.
What have I missed in that?
In book designer.
Oh, in the book designer. And does the person who hire you or the person you've interviewed have to approve each step along the way, or at some point do you have that autonomy to create this from their story and what you've learned from them?
I learned early on when I went to interview the bookbinders in Minneapolis, St. Paul, that you don't want to spend too much time on the particulars because people, they're not prepared to do that. What kind of cover? What is going to be the cost? What is going to be the grade? What are we going to do? What leather bound? All those kind of things. The first time I interviewed the bookbinderies, and it's a short run bookbindery, the owner of the particular one that I ended up choosing said, don't give them too many choices. Give them a little catalog that lists has 15 or 20 colors and make it library style because we expect those to last for about 500 years and limit that. That's really not the important thing. What's important is what's on the inside. I really learned from him that I was going to have a prepackaged deal. And even when I send out the marketing materials, I send out a sample book that's got the first paragraph of 9 different stories on it. And then they get the feel in their hand what that looks like, and then they get to choose a color. So that we spend our time emphasizing what's important.
That sounds so important. Yeah. When you describe this as a business, do you have a storefront operation at all? Or is it, in your case, all out of your home office? Or how do you do that?
The way I did it was out of my home.
Uh-huh.
Because I discovered I could have partners. And the internet makes everything so convenient now that I would have an agreement. It was just an agreement in a handshake with an editor who took a look at what I did and said, I'll charge you X number of dollars for editing per page or per word. And then I had an agreement with an editor who, I went through a couple editors because some of the editors were slow to get it done, and I'd have a birthday party that I'd have to have book done by, and if they didn't have it edited, everything else got backed up. I agreed with this one editor. She was going to do all my editing. Then I had a book designer who I discovered late into the process that I was doing it all myself initially and placing the pictures in the gallery in the back. It's cheaper that way, but of course, if you have a book designer, it looks, she abides by all the rules that were set up by the monks back in the 16th century. The chapters should start on a different, certain side and what the table of contents is and where you put the copyright, and all those rules really signify that you've got a published book that's good. So I found a book designer, and then I worked with the same bookbinder. So I had sort of a, and then I had to have an accountant, and I had to have an attorney. So all of those people were my partners in this business, and I paid them per project. And I didn't have the attorney, except once a year I'd have to consult with my accountant and my attorney, but I used them. There's a lot of small businesses out there. They're very accustomed to working with people on this kind of a basis. And home business is just growing exponentially these days.
And your book actually helps. I just want to put a plug in for the book for people to know that it really takes you step by step on how to set this up as a home visit, a home business, which is just amazing. Now, I understand that you only write stories with those now over 75 years old or in hospice. How did you come up with those parameters, and how has that been working for you?
Because I was a gerontologist, when I went back to school to get my master's in community health education, a lot of good people helped me. The person who was in charge of that program said to me, what are you going to do when you graduate now? How are you going to take this community health education and use it? And I said, I have no idea. He said, let me give you an idea. This baby boomer generation is going to cause a big boost, and you should get into gerontology. So I got into gerontology in 1979, which was early, and I am so grateful to him for giving me that tip. So that's how I got into gerontology, and then once I got into gerontology, then I got led down this path of starting my own business. Did I answer all the questions?
You have. And it is amazing. I always say to people, when you think about what are the hot industries now, gerontology with so many aging baby boomers and beyond is certainly the way to go. You spend a lot of time then working with an elderly client or working with maybe members of their families. How do you end the relationship? How do you say goodbye to them?
That's a really good question, Dorian. I found that the elderly person really loved the visits when I would go to their home and I would close the door and make everything comfortable for them so they could hear me and I could hear them, and I paid complete attention to them, and they didn't want it to end. In fact, I had family say, can't you just stop by Mother periodically once a month and visit her? She loves your visits. No, as a person who's in business, you can't do that. Plus, professionally, you can't do that. Once you're done with your job, you need to say goodbye and move on. And I talked to the Minnesota Historical Society and said, would you be interested in accepting these books? They took a look at my books. They loved them. They said, absolutely. Why don't you have them give us a copy? So I tried that with a couple families, and it didn't work. I found out some of them would say, I've never been in the doors. I don't know what to do. I made arrangements that I called them up and made an appointment. When we were, after the book signing party had been done for the family, that part of my process would be that they could donate a copy to the Minnesota Historical Society if they liked. If they were out of town, like if I had traveled to California to do it, I would recommend this to the family. But call up the person who's in charge of the library of the Historical Society, ask them if they're willing to review it and to consider putting it in the library. And I now have 69 books in the Minnesota Historical Society. And the people would be so thrilled. I'd take them out to lunch. They have a nice cafe there. It would be my treat them to lunch, bring some family along, and then we go up and present the book to the person in charge of accepting things for the library.
That makes it sound so special to have it there in the library. Mm-hmm. And you have these book signing parties. Can you describe them to all of the listeners and how to set them up, and do you follow any special procedures for it? How does that work?
Again, every family has their own tradition, their own culture. How do they do birthday parties? How do they do holidays? And when they would ask me that, I would say to them, think in terms of how do you do a birthday party? What do you do at a wedding? Because you can combine that kind of process of how you do a party for giving this book, distributing this book. In fact, if you have a wedding and everybody's coming in town for the wedding, do both at the same time. So that's how, and if you'd like to invite me, I'd love to come. But I don't make any assumptions that I know what's comfortable for your family. So just think in terms of how you plan an event and do it that way. And then I give them examples. For instance, one of the families I worked with set up in the living room a little desk where the narrator was signing the books with a fancy pen. And then each of the grandchildren would be invited up to be given a book individually by grandma or grandpa or whatever. So I give them a couple examples like that.
That's so nice. So you don't always go to the book signings?
Not unless I'm invited.
And are you usually, or how do
usually,
that?
Huh? And when I did a survey of my clients, I found out that 50% of the families had a book signing party. It makes them special. It's like queen for a day.
That is, and I remember reading, I think it was in your book or your article, that in some cases the book has been incorporated as part of the eulogy for the person and actually buried with the person. Can you talk a little about that?
Yes. The second man that I worked with, and this has happened more since then, they had called me up and said, Grandpa has died. It had been 8 years that he had that book. And he used to carry it around and say, they wrote a book about me. They just love that. They called me up and they said, Mary, Grandpa died last night. We know that he'd love to have you at the funeral. Can you please come? And I said, surely. I went to the funeral that happened to be in Wisconsin nearby, and it was a cold, blistery, wintry day, and I found my way out. It was in a beautiful little church in a small town in Wisconsin, and I found my way inside the church, and there was the minister up at the front. And I sat in the back row, and the minister was making the several announcements and the other part of the ceremony. And then he said, now, is there anyone that would like to come up and say something about Mr. Anderson? And he said, if you would, you can come now. And about 12 of the grandchildren stood up, each with a book in their arms, and marched up to the front altar and picked out their favorite passage. So I was there, and as I was ready to leave, the granddaughter that had hired me, she was the secretary across the hall in the hostel, she said, Mary, I'm so sorry you couldn't have been here last night. And I said, why is that? She said, because this book meant so much to Grandpa. We took one book, we all signed it, and we put it in the coffin. And other families have since done the same.
It's so moving of how just the importance of that. But as you said, too, just that sense, my life's worthwhile, or I'm a good person, or whatever the feeling is, because there's this book about me. It's really wonderful. Lori from Minnesota is asking a question. She says, it appears you're a true pioneer in the field of personal history. memoir seems to be a growing trend, so she's curious to know if people seem more interested in memoir now than they were when you first started.
That's really a good question. And when I started, people didn't believe that I was going to leave my quote-unquote profession to do this. I didn't look at it that way. I looked at it as a extremely special part of my profession as a community health educator to lead the community in honoring elder people. I believe now if I was quitting my job, nobody would be surprised. It's been in the papers that older people have their life stories written. It's been in the Atlantic magazine, in which is an important magazine, in August, had a 17-page story about how people are writing their life stories now. It's become a trend.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was in the process of leaving, the grant was over and I was leaving my job, people literally laughed at me. They said, "You're going to do what?" So that's the change that we've seen, and it makes me just so proud. It really does. That I could mention that now and people wouldn't get a funny look on their face.
You should feel proud. It's this wonderful work that you do. And again, in the sharing through your book on how people can make this a business, it really is quite lovely. Take us a little bit more through the process, if you would. In general, you work with one person and it's the privacy and confidential and you record it. Do you ever work with married couples? Do you ever work with divorced people, siblings? Can you share a little about how you approach it? Yeah.
Thank you. How the narrators I have found since I've started. Early on, I found a couple that were married 49 years, and they wanted me to help them write their life story. And this was about the fifth or sixth client. And I said, I don't do couples. I didn't know how I was going to handle a married couple. And the wife said, "You're going to learn, and we're going to help you."
That's good.
So
being a team.
I had done enough work in communicating with patients that I felt I could probably handle it, and I did it. And I developed some principles that both of them, both the couple, would have to be present at the same time so that I wouldn't cause a problem of, did you tell her this? Did you tell her that the three of us had to work together, and they agreed to that. Then I had to figure out how I would be sure that someone wouldn't be taking over the process. And I was very careful. If someone seemed to be taking too much of the time or telling too much of the story and not allowing the partner to be part of that, then I would just sit silently, let them tell what they say, and then I would again look at the person I was addressing, whichever partner it was, and say, "Now, can you tell me about your side of that?" Or something like that, where I would not be rude, but I would make clear that both people had equal time.
Mm-hmm.
When I've worked with sisters, it worked the same way, but I had to be careful to be sure that they each had their say. And when I worked with a group of four one time, they had six siblings originally in the family. Two of them had died, and that was the impetus for them wanting to get their story written. I had to do the same thing, and I would share with them, "I want each of you to have your time, but we've got to sit together as you tell your story so that you don't have conflicts after I leave the room, that I'm fully informed of what you want in this story." It worked out, and I learned on the road how to handle some of those things. But I then have shared that in my book of the principles of, if you're going to have more than one narrator, how do you handle that so that you don't have troubles after the book is published, that someone would come back and say, "There's 18 paragraphs about this and only two paragraphs about this." You have to be sure that you've got agreement of everybody before you take the investment of having something printed and bound in hardcover.
So you take that on up front, it sounds.
I do.
Can you share, I loved your creative way of how you do the binding sometimes if they're two people or maybe even divorced.
They're divorced, yeah.
Right.
I had two families where the grandparents had been divorced and the grandchildren said, we want their story so badly. Do you think you could do it? And I said, in fact, I had three. What I thought about was the children's book where you can, on one side, it opens from the left and you start reading the book, and then you turn the book over and it opens from the left, but it's on the other side.
Other side.
So that's what I talked to my bindery about. Can we do that? He said, no problem. We can do that without any problem. So I have three stories where there was a divorce involved, and that's how it's bound, so that it is their story. They each have their own part, and it can sit on the shelf for the grandchildren.
I love that example. I think it's great. What about, again, you mentioned this in the book and also in your article, but so sometimes in people's stories, there's secrets, some that somebody wants shared, some not necessarily. Can you share a little of maybe some examples on how you approach that?
I'm the middle of seven children, so I've got lots of experience with siblings and sibling rivalry and all those kinds of things, and that has been a great advantage to me. And I wanted to be sure that after the book was printed, even if my clients were 80 and 90 years old, I have found they still have sibling rivalry. They still have little issues that aren't necessarily seen the same way by everybody. What I do is I try to warn the narrator when we begin that if you're going to be describing your family, that's fine, and we will make some description of other people, but the only story that you're going to tell is your own. If you're the only one that graduated from college, that's okay, but you're just going to say you graduated from college. You're not going to mention that the other children didn't graduate from college, so that there won't be comparisons that will hurt the siblings or the siblings' children, because this is something that's going to go on for many generations. And also, the other thing that I felt I described as I developed as a principle was that after it was edited, there would be an invitation to one person who was close to them in the family or out of the family, but this person that they trusted, who I said, they're going to be your third eye. And the purpose is there might be a description of something in here that is offensive to someone in the family, and I can't see it because I don't understand the family dynamics like you do. We're going to have one person that you choose to read the story before it goes into the printer so that we don't hurt anybody's feelings. And also, the whole idea that if you want to know how the family's going to react, you're going to get a little peek preview. But that person that you're going to let read can't tell anybody until you distribute the book. And that has worked very well, too. And that way, we avoid having hurt feelings. Hurt feelings can ruin the whole thing. Here, you've put all this time and effort and excitement into it, and this one little word is bothersome, and only somebody in the family understands why that is bothersome. That I don't know if I've explained that clearly.
No, I think
enough.
You have, and it relates to a question that Jan has asked, and maybe you've already responded to, but let me read you Jan's question and see if there are other things you want to add. She says that she can think of a lot of ways that the information that comes out from the life stories of the interviewee can upset the individual or the family equilibrium.
Yes.
And how do you prepare the prospective memoirist to handle these situations?
That's my advice when I train people that want to do this work, that you've got to understand there's certain pieces of information that families have that belongs to them, and they shouldn't be announcing it to the rest of the world. But unless you're part of that, you might forget it. You might not understand it. And so having that third perspective is critical before you send it to the printer.
And that relates, you just mentioned about you handle that in the training. Another question that Jan has is two parts to this question. One, is there any ideal background for a good memorist? And also to talk a little about your memorist training program and how long is it and what's involved in it.
Thank you. The ideal person, I think.
Or ideal background of the person.
I think people who have a background in the helping professions are naturally attracted. When I have done training programs, usually it's somebody who's over 50 and they have a background in teaching, nursing, social work, chaplaincy, and surprisingly, attorneys. Every class that I've had an attorney in it. So interesting, but they have that perspective of looking at the whole family and not wanting for any harm to come from this book, or from the publication. What was the second part of the question, Dorian?
To talk a little more about your training program. How long is it? And I know right now it's just on the Cape, but maybe talk about that, or if are there possibilities of other places or whatever.
I have done the training program 3 times in St. Paul. I did it at St. Catherine University. And since I have moved to Massachusetts now, I've done it once here in Bridgewater State University, and they've invited me to come back. They said I can come back as much as I want because it was a huge success here, too. We had 16 people. It was 4 sessions, and the sessions were four hours long. It's very intensive. We meet once a week. I am thinking that in the future what I want to do is to have it 5 days in a row where I would say to people, you can fly into Cape Cod, bring your family, rent a place. Mm-hmm. You can come to class in the morning and have your afternoon with your family. And we'll see if the university wants that. I don't know that for sure, but I know I will be doing it again. It's 5 days. It's very intense. You get a lot of homework. But my students have told me they feel that I do an evaluation each time. They feel that they've gotten the nuts and bolts of what has to be done and what's to be avoided and where are the ways to market that are efficient so that you don't waste your time and energy trying to find clients. Because that's another thing that is really critical when you're doing a small business, that you're efficient. Because if you aren't working, you don't have any income coming in. You have to be very careful about being efficient. And when you get those prospective calls, how do you handle those so that they turn into a person who becomes a client?
Can you share a little of how you do that?
Oh, about marketing?
Yeah, the marketing piece.
Yes. Say I had an article in the paper, or I was on the radio, or I was on a talk show on the television, and that would be just a local talk show. What I developed the business principles that when I got home from being on a TV show, I would not answer the phone for a day. And the reason is, if you've got people calling in from several places, you don't want them to get a busy signal. Mm-hmm. So I would wait if they would call me and say they wanted to hire me for their family, I would get to them within the next couple days. But if I ran home and tried to answer the phone, the next person trying to call me is going to get a busy signal. We don't want that. So you have to look at all those things what's going on here so that you've got people coming and knocking on your door and saying they want you to write a life story for their family.
Hmm. Have there ever been, somebody asked this question, and I think it's a really good question, but didn't say who they were. Have there ever been times when you decided not to work with a family? And if so, what are some of the reasons that led you to make that decision?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. Mm-hmm. And one that I have spent many anguished hours about. I have had calls from people where they say, Dad died 3 weeks ago, and so we want Mom to get her story written. And I say, can we just talk about that a little bit? Because when your mother's just gone through this big loss, we really don't want to have her busy until she's ready to do something like that. Why don't you call me back? Now, I'm synthesizing these examples. Why don't you call me back in about 2 years? And then we can consider it. Because somebody who's just been through such a big loss, it's not a good time for them to write a story. They need to heal first. And I'd be very happy to work with them then. Or if somebody says, the first question out of their mouth is, how much does it cost? When I tell them it costs thousands of dollars, they're going to hang up the phone. I delay answering that question, and I say, now, who is this story for? Let me see if I can do for you what you want done. Tell me about your mother, or tell me about your dad. and I have them start talking about them, and they take off, and they give me a great big story. If they say the person has had a lot of hospitalizations because they've been had a lot of mental health problems in the past, I suggest to them that I don't have the skills to work with someone who has a history that's pretty complicated in that area, and that I'd be happy to find them someone who can work with them for that, but that I don't have the skills. Or if they say, my dad just had an amputation and he really needs something to keep him busy. And again, I think in terms of loss, and that losing a limb is a big deal, and I'm not going to come walking in the door and say, here, let me distract you. We're going to tell your life story. It ain't going to work. Mm-hmm. So that's another situation where I've learned, or I actually knew before times, because I'm old enough to know some of this stuff and have been working in the field long enough, that's not the appropriate time for somebody to be telling a life story. If they've had a loss, then they need to heal from that. And I've had experience with a woman who had lost a grandchild. And so that was her impetus. She told me right away that was her impetus. She wanted to hire me because her grandson had been killed, and she wanted to write her life story. And I told her I did not think it was wise. She absolutely insisted, and I did it. I interviewed her the first time. She wouldn't let me ask a question. She just rattled on and wouldn't have a conversation. She just wanted me to take the dictation. And I suggested to her that we take a break, and that if we could start again in a year or a year and a half, it might work better, because I couldn't write that fast. That was my excuse to her. But when you see those kind of behaviors, that you have to ask yourself, what's going on here? They really don't want to tell their story. There's something else that they want to do. They want to run away from the pain, usually, is what the answer is.
Right.
But you have to have a bit of wisdom under your belt. I don't think somebody who's 23 years old can do this job.
Mm-hmm.
You really have to be able to walk into a situation, survey what's going on, and take the lead from the clues that you even get walking in the door.
Mm-hmm. No, that sounds like very valuable wisdom to share. I'm just thinking that if I'm over 75 and you say that I'm going to come back in a year and a half, that may be hard, because I don't know if I'll be here in a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
But what I hear, which seems so important, is that although the telling their story can be very therapeutic, it's not therapy. And if somebody's really reeling from a loss, or there's something else going on, they really need some therapy. And the telling their story may have some cathartic aspects for them, but they really need to do some healing before really being able to use a service of a memorist, is what I'm hearing from it.
Exactly.
From your response. Do you see any gender differences in how people deal with all this?
Huh? It's been very interesting. I have found that men love their cars. They can tell me where they bought it, how much they paid, what the date was, what color it was, how many miles per gallon. It's just so interesting. And they also, men really concentrate a lot on their employment. And then women, I found, can describe what they were wearing, if something that was remotely in their childhood or something, and they can describe what clothes they had on. It's very interesting. They also can describe minute details from the births of their children. But we don't go into that in the memoir. It's really something that's mentioned. But I have found that their detail at those kind of moments is imprinted. It's really interesting.
That is very interesting. So I have another question from Lynn, and I discovered that Lynn was the person who, Lynn from New York, who asked the question about, have you decided not to work with a family ever? But she also asks, what would you like to see happen in the field of personal history that has not happened or been done yet? It seems there are so many opportunities for growth in this field of work.
Beautiful question. Wow.
Yeah.
What I'd like to see happen is a certification process, because to me, if we have an experience where somebody has someone who's not trained and it affects a family negatively, that is going to spread instantly. And that's what the risk is we're running when we do not have a credentialing process yet. So my hope is, before I die, that I can see that we have a credentialing process that's required. If you're going to be a personal historian, or as the word I use is a memoirist, that we can promise the public that we are safe to work with. That's what I'd like to see happen.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little more about what some of the risks are that you've seen over the years in terms of being a memoirist? It ties into your statement about the importance of credentialing, but I just wonder what are some of the risks that you see?
I went to a family home. Now, this was early on when I was just getting my feet wet. I went to a family home where there was tinfoil on the windows, and there was antenna up above. And it was in an area, it was in Minneapolis, was in an area that I was not familiar with, and I knocked on the door thinking, oh my gosh, what am I doing here? And a big German Shepherd comes to the door with the person who wants me to write his life story. And I thought, I don't know if I should go in. I'm scared to death. I went in, and the dog, there was another person in the house, and the other person in the house took the dog in another room, but the person was not mentally stable. And I had not screened carefully enough for his reason for wanting to tell his life story. That was risky. And you've got to protect yourself. The rule I made for myself as a result of that visit was, if when I'm screening someone by phone, I feel uncomfortable, I will meet with them at a restaurant. And then I'll be safe.
Mm-hmm.
Or at some other public place.
That is one of the risks of having an office in your home.
I don't interview people in my home. I go to their homes.
Okay.
I don't let people come to my house. I wouldn't want to expose myself that way.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so other risks. One time I flew out to Utah to do a life story, and I was going to stay in a hotel, and then I was going to go to the home to interview this person who was living with their grandchildren. And the day I arrived there, the woman landed in the hospital. And so I said, is she well enough that I can visit with her a little bit? She was well enough I could visit with her a little bit. So I would go there twice or three times a day and visit with her for a short period of time. And then I asked if they had any other documentation of stories about her. And she had a huge book that she had written in preparation for her wedding, which had been 50 years prior to that. I was able to put the story together enough that she was satisfied with it. In fact, she was delighted with it, and it didn't disturb her hospitalization at all. Another time I had been hired to go to a place in Wisconsin by the granddaughter who lived out on the East Coast, and I was coming from Minnesota. And she hired me, and she said she wanted to be there for the interview. And I said, that's against the agreement that I sign with people. I'm the only one in the room when somebody is interviewed. Oh, but Grandma really likes me, and I'm going to be paying for it. I said, I'm sorry. If you want to be in the room when she's interviewed, I'm not the person to hire because I don't work that way. Your grandmother's in charge. Lo and behold, I get off the plane in Milwaukee, and guess who's there to meet me at the airport? The granddaughter who flew in from New York or wherever she was coming from. I said, oh, hello, it's nice to meet you, but no, why are you here? I'm here to see your grandmother. She said, oh, no, I've got to be there with her. Mm-hmm. I said, okay, I'm going to get on the next plane and go home because I explained to you that I will not allow other people in the room. She said, but listen, I've got connections in New York, and I can get you on the Oprah show. I said, listen, I have principles that I provide complete privacy for the clients that I'm working with, and I will get on the plane to go home. Oh, okay. when you're working with the public, you got to be ready for those kind of things to happen. And it's been, all those things are lessons that I have shared in my book, that when you set up principles like that, you've got to have good reasons for doing it, and you've got to know that is the principles that your company is going to be based on, and that is your reputation. And without a good reputation, you're not going to have a business, and you're not going to be doing good work.
So it sounds like you have to really think clearly every step of the process is what
very
I hear.
Much.
That's so important.
You have to be very independent, and you have to be very mature about even if you are having financial troubles, this cannot affect a professional relationship.
So are there other, I just want to comment that I guess I wasn't clear at the beginning about having people put their names on their questions, and I actually attributed two questions to Lynn and only one was from her, and I don't know who the other person who wrote. The only reason why it's helpful is since I'm going to be picking one to send a book to, it'd be helpful to know everybody's name when they ask a question, but I do apologize for not making that clear at the beginning. So I did want to comment on that. So if the person who wrote to me and said that you didn't know you needed to add the name, if you wanted to send me your name, that would just be really helpful, but you don't have to. But back to the risks again, I just want a couple more things, and I know we're a little over, but just to, so you mentioned people over 75 and hospice. What do you find in the hospice setting? Because I would imagine that could be a bit potentially difficult, too, if it's right near the end of somebody's life.
It can be one of the best things that can happen to people in hospice, is what I have found, if they are willing to do it, number one.
Yep.
And that's really, you've got to abide by the principles of they're not being forced into this. But what I found is that when people have something that they know they are leaving behind, and it's in their words, and they will be remembered the way they want to be remembered, and then you promise them that you're going to work with them on a book signing party, they have something to look forward to. It really does help the process.
So it's really part of the legacy making.
So it can be a very positive thing in hospice.
And what about, are there any sort of psychiatric diagnosis or dementia or any mood disorders, psychosis, any situations that you find aren't as conducive to memoir writing, or some that are, even though people might be frightened away by it because of a particular diagnosis?
I have spent many hours working with Gerald's psychiatrist about this question. Is there something that I should, that would provide a red flag, and then I have given them experiences that I've had, and they have agreed with me. So I've consulted with several Gerald psychiatrists about this. And if the person has multiple hospitalizations for mental illness, that's something that I would avoid. And if they, I'm trying to think of the other thing that they said to me. That's the only one that comes to my mind. The others are in my book, I know. And that's the only one that comes to my mind on the spur of the moment, that multiple hospitalizations for mental illness, you are have a great risk of running into, when you're doing a life review, that they slip into the feeling that you're the therapist. And you just don't want that to happen, not unless you're a therapist. And I have plenty of friends who are therapists who are doing this also, so then I can say, I can refer you to somebody who can help you, because they have both the training in doing life stories and therapy part of it.
That's helpful. And what about one last question that I want you to leave us with a takeaway, but I know in the book you mentioned that you say to people, if there's any time you want me to turn the recorder off, I'd be happy to, or if somebody says something, they may talk with you about wanting to have it be part of it or not. Can you just talk a little bit about that?
Before I turn on the recorder, and now we do usually digital recording, I tell them that often when we're done, the family will say, can we have a copy of the interview recording? And so part of my little beginning to work with them is to say, do you mind if your family wants a copy of this recording? Is that okay? And if they say okay, then I mark it on my little sheet that it's okay. If they say no, I want to be able to talk to you in complete confidence, and I don't want anybody else to hear what you and I are saying, then I mark it on my little sheet that I keep on everybody, their personal record, that no one else is to hear what's on that recording. Also, I do tell people that if they slip and we're talking about something, and we do it in a conversational setting, that they might say, oh, I never should have said that. I don't want that recorded. Then when I'm transcribing, I erase it.
Mm-hmm.
I promise them that I will do that.
So sometimes the benefit can be just telling the story, but not necessarily having everybody else have all the information.
That happens. That happens. I had a 91-year-old woman that had been sexually abused when she was 13 years old. She had never told anyone about it. It was by her physician. Mm-hmm. And she said all she wanted was to be able to tell one person.
Mm-hmm.
Those kind of things come up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I wrote that book, because I've learned from the clients that I worked with what things can't happen when you're doing a personal history. I think it's a really important profession, and I think it's really important that we honor the fact that when people tell their story, that is something that's part of their soul, and we have to honor that if we're going to be doing a good job.
And it certainly sounds like you honor so many of these people and these stories that you have. And I think you just said it so beautifully. It's honoring their soul. And that really is what the work, I think, of a memoirist is. This has been so lovely, Mary. I so appreciate your being part of the call today. And Mary, what's the final takeaway that you'd like people to have? And before you do the final takeaway, maybe remind people your website and your email, but also any just your final takeaway from this really lovely discussion about being a memoirist.
Thank you, Dorian. This has just been an honor to be part of your programming. I just love what you do. And thank you for including me. My website is www.memoirsinc.com. And my final takeaway would be, I think that the honoring that the new technology that we can do life stories for everyone is just one of the best parts of the evolution of the population. Because we have technology, we can do this. We can honor each other. And it's a loving thing to do. And I have been inspired by the stories I've heard from people. It's amazing that the ripple effects that you can have when you are willing to tell your story. It affects the inside of you as the narrator, and it can affect everybody around you. It's a very positive profession, and I think it's something that we need to publicize and encourage education so that we can have more stories recorded. And thank you again very much, Dorian, and for all of you in the audience that participated, for your questions.
Great. Take care, everybody. And thanks again, Mary, for sharing from your heart and soul and your book that I really recommend to people. It's called Becoming a Memoirist for Elders, Create a Successful Home Business. And for any of you who are listening who are thinking about wanting to do this, I really recommend that this kind of gives you a good template and basis for being able to really think about what's involved. So
and it's available
again
on Amazon.com.
Okay, great. And it's available on Amazon.com. Great. Thank you very much, Mary, and hope to see all of you in another month. Take care. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Revolutionize Your Retirement Radio with Dr. Dorian Mintzer. To learn more about the resources mentioned on today's show, listen to past episodes, or download our free retirement transition guide, visit revolutionizeyourretirementradio.com.